Welcome to the Billionaire Lifestyle Podcast with your host, Emmett Muckles. Please visit iTunes, Stitcher, or emmettmuckles.com to listen to all the episodes for free.
Ladies and gentlemen, your man Emmett Muckles is here, and today I have a wonderful guest for you. We're going to be talking about Escaping Oz. Now, I don't think you guys are the Scarecrow. I don't think you're the Tin Man, but we know that we are in a reality where we have to navigate something. So basically, we're going to escape Oz today, and we're going to navigate the crisis with my man Jim. How you doing today, Jim?
Emmett, thanks a lot for having me on today.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. You know, we're busy people today, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to give the Billionaire Lifestyle audience, you know, a taste of what you've thought about, what you've digested, and what you've processed for us. So your book, Escaping Oz, is Navigating the Crisis. How did that come about?
Well, Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, Emmett, is the second book in the series of three. That book was published in 2015. The most recent book is called Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflections. It came about because over the course of my career of what I'll call my paying job, I developed a keen interest in finance and the economics, did a lot of commodity trading on the side, and even pursued my Series 3 license with the hope of one day managing money in a commodity futures fund. Never actually pursued that angle, but still stayed very, very close to it. And right around the time of the financial crisis, I started writing for a national publication that was called Examiner.com, which at the time was one of the fastest growing online news sources. And I had my own column there. Also had a column here in St. Louis, Missouri as well that dealt with finance and economics. So I developed that passion and I realizing what was going on in the economy, and that really and I still think there's probably a good sense of financial and economic illiteracy, again, through no fault of the populace. It's just something that's not really taught in schools. And frankly, I think you probably have to engage in a lot of self-learning for that. So that's kind of the impetus for it. And then late 2010, early 2011 is when I published my first book in the Escaping Oz series.
All right. So, you know, one of the things about financial literacy is that most of the time, most of us have no clue, and it's some epiphany in your adult life that you have, and you say, I'm sick of this, and there has to be a way out. And if you're lucky, you will pick up on the clues and understand what is happening about you. In addition to that, the news media doesn't help, because I remember they were saying everything is peachy, and then all of a sudden everything crashed down. Do you think that we should backtrack in our society and put a focus on this so that the economy and the future can prosper? And I know I'm getting off a little bit, but this is just one of my peeve topics about money in general and teaching people about money.
Yeah, you bring up a great point. And that epiphany, I guess, that you just mentioned hit people square in the face in 2008, you know, with the financial crisis. And, you know, that elevated, I guess, the economy and financial markets a little bit more into the national consciousness. Obviously, we had something not quite to the same severity in the year 2000. So within, let's say, the context of this century, this millennium, you know, we've had two, you know, significant financial events. There was engagement, but I agree with you. There's probably not a lot of emphasis on that. And, you know, some of it in the book that you mentioned earlier, Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, I try to go back to those fundamentals to try to teach people, have them understand a little bit more about what money really is and, you know, how it's evolved for us, not just, you know, economically from the standpoint of, you know, when Christopher Columbus discovered America, but how it's evolved from the standpoint of or the origins of our nation, you know, from the late 18th century. So if you don't understand money, and I come from an engineering background, it'd be kind of akin to saying, well, I don't have a good grasp of math. So if you don't have a grasp of math, you'll never get to understand algebra or calculus or differential equation. So it's kind of the same thing. Money is, you know, the most important economic invention of all time. So it's really important to understand it.
Now, in your writings, there's basically, and in society, we only need about to understand about five things. Can you touch on those real quickly?
Yeah. In the last book that I wrote, published in the summer of this year, Escaping Oz, An Observer's Reflections, I noted there were five things that a society really needs to function. And again, this is kind of going back to those fundamentals. And I said, what I did is I created the metaphor of a bazaar. So if you have this bazaar, in that bazaar, you have people selling goods and you have people selling services. And so those are the two things, you know, just for commerce. And then the thing that greases the skids or facilitates all that in substitution for barter is what I just mentioned a minute ago, is money. So you have goods, services, and money. Well, those three things are not in itself enough to make sure that you have a functioning, orderly bazaar, or in this case, a society on a larger scale. And so what I postulated was that on top of that, you needed two other things. You needed civil law to make sure that people do what they said they were going to do. And they also need criminal law. So to make sure that, you know, you don't have marauders stealing your goods in the bazaar. So when you have all those five things, goods, services, money, again, the most important economic convention, civil and criminal law, those are the base things that you need to have for a society to function well.
But what about when the law is not fair across those planes? It's particularly so the constituencies of the bazaar, but it favors the bazaar or the shop owners of the bazaar itself.
And see, here's the problem that I delve into a little bit more in again, Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflections, is that we have become a nation, a world, if you will, that is just smothered, if you will, with laws, rules, and regulations. And the more laws, rules, and regulations you have, there is actually the greater opportunity for corruption. And to your point, the people that will be able to take advantage of those corruptive influences of having so many laws, rules, and regulations are the people that have more means. And so there's probably not a better example of the profusion of laws, or in this case, rules or regulations, than the United States tax code, which I think it's appropriate to talk about that right now in light of, you know, the bill that's currently passing through Congress. And what's interesting about that is if you look at the number of pages that are part of the tax code, you know, you got to ask yourself, you know, all we're really trying to do is collect money for the functioning of government. And yet, you know, we have this voluminous, tax code. And so you got to ask yourself the question, why is it so big? Well, the reason it's so big is because you've had influencers by virtue of lobbyists, you know, maybe that circular door that exists between Congress and then the private sector, in particular lobbyists, where you have influences about how to craft the tax law to create some advantage for, again, fill in the blank, whether it's an industry, an individual, and so forth. And so that, again, that leads to corruptive influences, because when you have so many exceptions, and for anybody that's ever done their taxes that's listening today, I think you understand what I mean. You know, if you were born in the state of Montana on a Tuesday under the sign of Taurus, you know, on a Wednesday, you know, we have a tax break for you, you know, and that's how granular the tax code can be. And what I argue in the book is that it really doesn't need to be that complicated, but yet it is, and there's a reason for that. And again, that kind of underpins, if you will, some of the corruptive influences that we have by having too many laws, rules, and regulations.
You know, one of the things that I have discovered over the course of my lifetime is that if you really want to be involved in the game, you need to be a business owner. And I am a proponent of people making their own business, because that's what this country was founded on, was small business. How do you think that should play in turning people's around social apathy from government in their life with their finances?
Well, that's a really good question too, and it's interesting that you ask it, because my paying job, the one that pays the bills, is I'm a small business consultant, and I help small businesses with general consulting. I also help them with what I'll call alternative finance and debt mediation. And I think if you talk to a lot of small business owners, they'll tell you how difficult it is to start a small business and to keep a small business running. I help them with the financial aspects of that, but many of them complain about obviously how many rules and regulations there are in order to have things function. And if you read some journals that talk about countries in the world where it is easiest to do business or to start a business, it oftentimes is not the United States. So that's something that, again, it feeds into what I was talking about earlier. When you have this profusion of laws, rules, and regulations, and again, in this case, the context is as it applies to small business, it does kind of create that apathy. And until you start to kind of knock down that edifice that we've created, we've allowed it to happen, you know, as voters, because, you know, we've been apathetic from a voting perspective, because we're allowing this to continue. And so until we start knocking some of that down, it does kind of create that apathy. And, you know, without small business, it's difficult for the economy to grow.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I am always watching is how the money is. Let me rephrase this. I'm watching how people think about the government, how they think about the economy, and there seems to be a disconnect. And I know that's probably where that apathy comes from. But do you think there's a fracture situation here, a fracture in between, or communication between the two, like government and the population?
I do, and part of it are some cyclical influences that I mentioned in Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. I mean, one of the things I do there is I talk about cycles, and we're going through a particularly pernicious part of a longer term cycle where you've got a bubbling up of anger. I think we've seen that manifested quite well in our political culture today. The 2016 election was probably a great exemplification of that conflict that exists. You know, not just between the people and the government, but, you know, the people and the opposite, let's say, political party. And we know that there's greater and greater sense of polarity that exists today within the voting population. You know, the people that, you know, maybe identified themselves, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago as Republican may, you know, had some malleability, if you will, about, you know, their political preferences. Now, you know, somebody that's a Republican is very much a Republican, and somebody who's a Democrat is very much a Democrat. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that we've actually, and the government and politicians have done this, I think, very consciously, is they've herded everybody into a small section of the political spectrum. And let me explain. The political spectrum, as I define it in the book, is not, okay, you've got Democrats on the left and Republicans on the right. The political spectrum actually starts on one pole, which is what I'll call anarchy, which is nobody's in charge. And the other pole is what I'll call the isms, you know, communisms, fascisms, and socialism. and so, truly, that is the true political spectrum. And so what we have today is we have a subset of that spectrum with the Democratic and Republican Party that I would submit to you has moved more from the time of our founding in 1776, have moved more towards the ism. And again, that gets back to what I was talking about earlier, that profusion of laws, rules, and regulations. And so both parties have moved much further towards those isms. And what I argue in the book is that when you look at the political spectrum differently, just like I just described it, you will see how both parties, again, have drifted everybody in one direction. They try to create these differences between the two. But in the grand reality, I would say there's much more similarity between them, and especially when you start talking about economic topics.
You know, I have to concur with you on that one. And one of my wife is Austrian, so we visit Austria, and they just had an election. In their election, they have about 5 to 7 parties that people can functionally choose from, while we really only have 2, with a fringe of maybe 2 more outside of that. Do you think that with the population, when economic times get just a little bit uncomfortable, we begin to ask government to do too much?
We do. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the thing about the other political parties in your wife's home country of Austria, because one of the things that I point out in the book, An Observer's Reflections, is that in the 2016 election, you had 3 candidates that, again, in my humble opinion, fit not into the Democratic or Republican Party. Candidate number one was Dr. Ben Carson, who, if people remember, he was actually a leader in the early Democratic polls. You know, when you had 16 or 17 people up on that stage for the very first, you know, Republican debate.
Yeah.
And so he does not fit in any particular party. The second candidate is our current president, the 45th president, who has no political allegiance whatsoever. I mean, it should have told you that when the Republican Party themselves did not want him elected, right? You had the Never Trump movement. And then the third candidate is Bernie Sanders, who calls himself what? He calls himself a Democratic Socialist. He's classified as an independent. You know, he's not a Democrat, you know, in the congressional roles. And so I do not find that in the least bit odd, because when I wrote my first book, I said there's a bubbling anger, and this is going back to 2010. There's a bubbling anger occurring in the country that I first saw manifested in, probably 2008, 2009. I saw that first with the Tea Party, and then I saw that with the Occupy movement. And, you know, those obviously movements, that, you know, both of those movements, if you will, those protest movements, you know, did not necessarily overlap. I mean, they had their own ideas. And so what I would say is that as you move towards more economic strife, you will see other ideas that bubble up and that people find appealing. And I'm sure that if, you know, let's just say 10 years ago, if you had said that Donald Trump was going to be elected president of the United States, I don't think he would have been taken seriously. And again, it's not to attack the man per se, but it's if you think about, you know, who he was and, you know, what position he occupied in American society. But again, that shows you what happens as, you know, people feel disenfranchised, et cetera, et cetera. And if I could add one more thing to this, in my fictional series, my first book in the fictional series is called 2020, which deals with the American presidential election in the year 2020. I actually have other what I'll call viable political parties that are part of that election race. And again, it creates some very interesting dynamics. But I would submit to you that particularly what I see right now, a very fractured Republican Party, a somewhat fractured Democratic Party, it wouldn't surprise me when you got close to 2020 if some of the things that I have in my fictional books actually come to fruition.
Ooh-wee. You know, I've been watching lately because it's been in the conversation of America, which is cryptocurrency, particularly Bitcoin. I remember when I was first introduced to Bitcoin, which was probably about 2008 or 2009, where it was probably $50 for Bitcoin. Right now, it is between $16,000 and $19,000 per Bitcoin. If you would have got in early and bought maybe 100 shares, you'd be very wealthy comparably. Do you think this interest in this cryptocurrency is looking to take over or replace cash? Because we're almost in a cashless society now with the advent of the credit cards and the debit cards. What's your feelings on a cashless society?
Well, that's a pretty complex, there's a lot of moving parts in that question. I will tell you that.
Yeah, that's true. I'm good for that.
I will tell you that that I've written three articles. You know, for those that are interested, they can come to my author website, jimmoscara.com, where I address actually all three of those. One is, again, what I'll call the cashless society. And the other are two articles that I've written, one in August, one I just published last week on Bitcoin. And, you know, the thing that people need to remember is, you know, we've had digital currencies for quite a while. And what I mean by that is that most of the money that's in circulation in the economy or in the world economy does not exist in those green pieces of paper that you have in your wallet.
You are absolutely right.
You know, they are digital entries that are in, you know, banking cyberspace, right? And so it's not cryptographically oriented, so it's not encrypted, but we do have digital currencies. And that doesn't matter, you know, whether we're talking about dollars, euros, or, you know, British pound or Japanese yen. The question that you bring up, though, in terms of the cashless society is a particular concern, because if you ever move to a 100%, and I'm not talking about cryptocurrencies here, just cashless digital dollars and the other currencies that I mentioned, you'll have a situation where every single transaction in your life, whether it's, let's go back to that bizarre example, goods or services that you're transacting in, are going to be recorded. And, you know, for those of us, I guess, that are concerned about privacy matters, you know, you're going to have essentially your life on display somewhere. We know that that hackers have made, made their way with, social security numbers. If imagine that everything's online in that fashion. The other thing that I caution people about with having everything digital is that we know that many people are victims of identity theft. And sometimes those people that are victims of identity theft, well, what happens? They can't access their bank accounts because something's locked up there. And so then what do you do? So cash is always a good thing for that. And the other is imagine that there's an electrical disturbance, right? And so you can't access, your money in the ATM. You can't use your credit card, your debit card at your local merchant. And so now all of a sudden what happens? So if you were to totally eliminate cash, it creates these secondary dangers that I don't think a lot of people have considered.
Oh, my goodness. You really made me think about it. So that would change the landscape literally of our world, because now wars wouldn't be really physical. You could just pop an EMP over a nation and it's a done deal.
Yeah, and the EMP question is an interesting one, because there's some prognostication of, what that would do to, the internet, your computers, et cetera, cell phones. And so if it were, in fact, that bad, imagine, if you didn't have another medium of exchange, paper, coins, or et cetera, to transact in, and everything would be locked up. Imagine that chaos. And so I always encourage people that, don't get me wrong, I'm not a Luddite. I don't want to go backwards, with the technology. But by the same token, don't be in such a rush to get rid of cash, because it could be your savior someday.
So do you, and now that we're talking about cash, do you think that we will actually get to a point where we say this doesn't work and we go back to a standard that is finite, such as gold or silver or something of that nature?
One of the things that I think that we're not quite at that point yet, but the next significant financial and economic crisis will call probably into question, our fiat currencies. And when I say that, I'm not just talking about the dollar. Any other currency that exists in the world is by fiat, which means it's by decree. The government says, what it's worth. And there are a whole host of problems associated with having fiat currencies. I mean, I can talk about wealth and income inequality that I think are integrally tied to that. I can talk about our fiscal deficit position, our unfunded liabilities. All of those things are much, much easier to have occurred with fiat currencies. So since you don't have any sort of, let's call it a regulation mechanism in the creation of our money, and we know what happened after 2008, that what I call the wizards of the Federal Reserve and other central banks, swooped in and just bought things and created trillions of dollars out of thin air. That's a significant amount of power that they exercise in order to, quote, save the economy. But some of the downstream effects from those actions are being felt today. Some of them are manifested in the bubbles, the financial bubbles that you see in the stock and bond markets. The attraction, we were talking earlier about the cryptocurrencies, is that with something like Bitcoin, well, yes, there's only 21 million Bitcoins that will ever be created. So some financial purists would say, okay, there's a natural limit that exists there that does not exist with fiat currencies. So it's very, very possible that the next financial crisis, and it's interesting we're talking about this, because I do mention this in my fictional books, that, okay, well, what happens during the next big financial crisis? How are governments going to react? And my prediction to you is that you'll have some part of the population that will, just like they always do, turn to the government for their salvation. And then you'll have others that will create tension by saying, no, it's the government that actually created all these problems. We need to solve this in a different way. And I'm kind of highlighting there some of the tension that exists in my novel series, where you have, kind of that push-pull effect of, what should government do and how should they save us, and should they save us at all?
Man, you got some, I could talk to you all day, literally all day. So one of the things about the United States, and I've heard this in conversations with people that I have been in circles with, is the fact that, nations tend to do really well when they're on the growth, when they're on the build, when they're new, or they've are progressing forward. And it seems like we've hit our tipping point because we don't do a lot of manufacturing here anymore. We're mostly a service-based economy. And I see a lot of societal discord. Where do you think that comes from? Is it just financial or is it more than that? Is it an ideology that's adding to that fire?
I would say some of all that. You know, I would always tell you that if an economy's healthy and everybody feels economically healthy, you will have much more societal harmony than if it's not healthy. Okay, and you know, part of societal health is at least some closer measure, if you will, of income equality and wealth equality. And I actually have some charts in the book Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, that shows a very direct correlation between income and wealth inequality and the stock market. And so what you'll see is during periods of, you know, of peak stock market valuations, you'll see income and wealth inequality start to get even wider. And of course, that creates a lot of, you know, societal ills. And let's look back to what I was talking about earlier, which is, you know, when you have this profusion of laws, rules, and regulations, you know, who influences that? It's the people that have more money, more means, more attorneys, more power that they can exercise in Washington, D.C., or let's say even state capitals. And so when you look at what happens during stock market lows, you'll see that wealth and income inequality get a little bit tighter. And while there were, you know, while there will always be, you know, a certain degree of wealth and income inequality in capitalist countries, and I would even submit in socialist and communist countries, you always see some degree of inequality, we've exacerbated that significantly, and especially post 2008, with this just creation of trillions of dollars by central banks, and you know that wealth, if you will, that wealth effect has not propagated to Main Street, right? Where is it all gone? It's gone towards Wall Street and elsewhere. And you know what we were talking about earlier about Bitcoin is really kind of symptomatic of that. Where, you know, I can't go and I talk to my mom, who's in her late 70s. You know, has made a comment to me about what I know. She can't just put money in a CD in a bank like the old days. And so, what you have is this explosion of newly created money by the wizards is just fostering a culture, if you will, of people just trying to chase yield. And with the Bitcoin, it's like a gold rush, right? I mean, people just don't want to miss out. It's that fear of missing out because you know they realize that they haven't saved enough for retirement. The debt levels are too high, so they need some salvation out of it. And so it pushes people into riskier and riskier ventures, which in the end is going to be even more catastrophic for the economy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that because, you know, I often ask my friends, I'm like, do you, or people that I know, I'm like, do you have $1,000 you can put your hands on? And most of them say, no, but I got open credit. And I'm like, wow. But one thing sticks out, and I was reading something when I was in New York, and then later on, something just kind of hit me because I was walking in front of this building, and it's called the Empire State Building. I was like, why did they name it the Empire State? Historically, we've heard about empires. Do you think we are classically an empire as the United States because of our military and our financial beings in the United States and just our overall power?
Yeah, I like the way you introduced that question by making the reference to the tall building in New York. And so after World War II, particularly since we were part of the victorious Allied powers, you know, the United States was really able to establish itself as, you know, one of the global superpowers, you know, perhaps the global superpower at that time. And, you know, one of the byproducts of victory, if you will, was the creation of what's called the Bretton Woods Agreement, which allowed the United States to have its money, the dollar, be the reference point for all other currencies in the world, and ostensibly that dollar was tied to some amount of gold. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up is because, you know, once you have the preeminent reserve currency in the world, it allows you to do certain things that other countries cannot do. And part of that is, and we talked, you introduced this by talking about an empire, is part of that, it facilitates the building of an empire. Well, and how do you do that? Well, you have to have a very massive military budget. Well, how do you have a massive military budget? Well, you know, you create those expenditures, you know, via congressional decree, right? And so we have a massive military budget. And if you compare that even to the other, let's call them superpowers in the world today, China and Russia, I still believe that our defense expenditures exceed both of theirs combined, and probably with some to spare. And so, and so, what you have is, you know, you have a presence, a military presence, not just in the naval and the sea passages, but you also have them in individual countries. You know, we found out the other day, or maybe a month ago, that the United States had some troops in somewhere in Central Africa, and you know, I was like, well, wow, I knew we had bases everywhere, but what are they doing in Central Africa? And they said, well, they're building a drone base there. And so part of, you know, so what we've actually done is we've extended ourselves, because we know we've extended ourselves, overextended ourselves, because we have a $20 trillion deficit. National debt. That's the funded debt. And that doesn't even include unfunded liability. So that's part of the stress, the economic stress that gets put on a country when it tries to become an empire. You know, the other part of it is, you know, you try to exert your will or your ideology on other countries that, you know, frankly, may not appreciate. In fact, in many cases, do not appreciate it. You anger other countries by having, you know, your troops stationed in there. And I'm not talking about places necessarily like South Korea, where they're there by treaty, but you know, you just have a military presence. And so that tends to create a lot of stress, you know, economic stress. And you know, in the case of the Middle East and Afghanistan, you know, Afghanistan, we've been in Afghanistan for what, the last 16 years? And you know, if you talk to, or if you read what some of the assessments on the ground there are, you know, we're not winning, I guess, to whatever the definition of winning means in Afghanistan. And so you look at how much money has been spent in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, and you look at the conditions that exist in those countries, the number of people that have died. And again, you got to ask yourself, you know, what was the net gain of all that? You know, look at all the people, all the soldiers, the courageous men and women that have gone overseas. They return home. If they return home at all, they're maimed. They're suffering from PTSD. You know, and those are big social important questions that you got to ask. And that's all part of being an empire. And as the empire gets older and older and older, it starts to kind of fray a little bit at the edges. And I think that the American population, for the most part, and I think this will happen in 2020, is that you'll see less and less of let's call it an enthusiasm for fighting these conflicts abroad, if we're not, you know, pretty mentally war weary already.
You know, one of the things, or the slogan that is so popular in America, is the Make America Great Again. Now, for me, as a person of color, that has a wholly different connotation, because it harkens to a time before. And the times before, particularly like right before I was born, it was a very different landscape for everyone, you know, where it was mostly centric on a certain population. Do you think we really understand what we need for to be free? And like you said, there's a difference between freedom of and freedom from.
Yeah, so let's talk about both of those things. So Make America Great Again, I don't know if a lot of people realize it, that was actually a slogan that came about first during Reagan's run in 1980. So the 45th president didn't necessarily coin that term. And as I mentioned before, he was one of three characters in the 2016 election, again, that didn't fit any particular political profile. But yet he was saying those things to the people that felt very disenfranchised. And, you know, part of that disenfranchisement, if you want to call that, you know, the flyover America portion of the voting block, that, you know, they needed to hear somebody that would tell them something that made them, you know, feel better about themselves, their economic, again, back to the economic prospects, right? What was he selling, you know, to his voters, right? He was selling that economically they would be better off. And forget about some of the political, you know, kind of baggage that was kind of being strewn around at the time that he was making about his opposition candidate on the Democratic Party. I'm just saying that the thing that people were following him on was there was some sense that, okay, here's this businessman, and yes, he must know about how to make America great again from an economic perspective. Now, I can highly debate whether he understands that or not, but let's get back to your second part of the question, which is the freedom from and freedom of. In this country, you know, we have a Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights, of course, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and those are the freedoms that were codified in this very important document that was created, you know, near the start of our nation's history. And what I submit, and let's go back to that political spectrum that I was talking about earlier, is we've actually moved further away from that by constantly asking the government to do something that gives us some freedom from, not freedom of. So we have freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of religion. But now we're asking for freedom from something. You know, it might be maybe health. It may be for, you know, for to protect us financially in our old age. Remember the laws, rules, and regulations that I was talking about earlier, you know, and that not just at the Washington, D.C. level. It occurs at a state capital, maybe even a local level. And so those are the freedoms from, you know, so we want these protections, right? Well, in order to have all these protections or freedoms from, we have to have a bigger and bigger government. Well, what happens when you have bigger and bigger government? Back to that profusion of laws, rules, and regulations. What happens when you have that? It opens it up towards more corruption. So, you know, we've asked government to do more and more. They don't always do it well. They cannot do it effectively from a budgetary perspective. We know that because we're $20 trillion in the hole, and that's just the funded debt. So, I mean, I can point numerically to the fact that we shouldn't be asking government to do so much. And the fact that we have, again, we the people, we've asked government to do that, has caused and is continuing to cause some of these problems that are kind of like unforeseen consequences of the actions that we've asked government to do.
Awesome. Now, I'm going to tell you this right now. I really enjoy having you on the show. Extremely. So let's make sure that we don't become strangers. How's about that?
No, it's been a pleasure being on the show with you, Emmett.
Are there any takeaways that you can give the Billionaire Lifestyle audience before you go?
Yeah, I really would. I conclude both of my books that we mentioned today, Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, Escaping Oz, and Observer's Reflections, by trying to get people, let's say, more civically engaged than they have been in the past. And part of that is understanding the issues and really, and you might say, well, Jim, you're just promoting your own book. And I am, obviously. That's why we're having this discussion. But by the same token, Emmett, the stuff that I talk about in my books, it's very apolitical. I have no political allegiance to either party, and it's just about, you know, facts, and it's about, you know, getting you to understand certain things, because, you know, we're continuing to elect people that don't have this understanding, if you will, of how to do things. And you know, and part of that's that apathy that you were talking about earlier. And so if we continue to do that, we're going to end up with another 2016 election where neither candidate was very popular, even within their own party. I mean, we know that, right? I mean, we can admit that, you Absolutely. Know, neither the Democratic candidate or the Republican candidate was particularly popular within their own party, within their own supporters. So again, what does that tell you, right? And so my takeaway for your audience is, you know, get out there and learn. Become more educated in some of these very, very fundamental topics, which, again, a lot of them have to do with, you know, the economy and money and things of that nature. Become become more literate, and then ask those questions. You know, instead of having these silly presidential debates where, you know, you got one guy hovering too close to, you know, to the other candidate, and they're sniping at each other, you know, and they're sniping at each other about, you know, something that's totally nonsensical. You know, let's talk about some real issues. And the fact of the matter is that we as a society have been very negligent in forcing that sort of discussion between our political leaders and people that are going to run for office. And until we do that, we're not going to solve anything.
Awesome. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for your time. Like I said, let's not be strangers, because you have a great deal of information that will benefit us all. And you have enough, you got enough energy to give us that drive. So thank you so much.
A pleasure being with you today, Emmett.
Last thing we have to say. So where can people find you? Twitter, Facebook, website, LinkedIn, everything.
I'm on all the above, but the best place to look for me is on my author website, which is jimmosquera.com. So that's JimMosquera.com. Once you get there, you'll see all the books. There's some video trailers associated with them, you know, different places you can buy. And I should also mention, Emmett, that because I understand that a lot of people sometimes don't like to read or don't have the time to read, I have actually recorded 4 audiobooks that are available as well on some of these topics. So there's something there for everybody.
Are they available on Audible?
Yes, sir, they are.
Awesome. So I'm going to get those like ASAP. So, ladies and gentlemen, here's how we end it. Remember, you are a diamond. You are like a star in the sky that you see from Earth when you are in a blacked out area. You're so unique. You're part of the multiple. You are a billionaire. And I'm going to prove it to you. Look at your hand. Look at the tip of your finger and look down towards your wrist. You're looking at the palm of your hand with your hand open. So between there is at least 1 billion cells. You own those. No one can really take those away from you. You've had 1 billion thoughts, 1 billion emotions. I bet you have. That means you're a billionaire. So everything else is extra. So you need to start living that life. And I don't mean to be preachy to you, but it's so important for you to understand that you are a spiritual being having a physical experience. So you're the video game. You control it. So why not just go be the most that you can be and live the experience that you came to this planet to do? Remember, love yourselves and treat the other person on the other side of your eyeballs as you would like to be treated, and make it just and full of love. Till next time, peace. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks a lot, Emmett.